This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. We'll compete with confidence. We'll cooperate wherever we can. We'll contest where we must. That's the new China strategy as outlined by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken earlier this year. But just exactly how countries should deal with China, including working with it when the times call for it, is perhaps the thorniest question in international relations today, at least in the West. Scott Moore gives his framework on the U.S. and China in China's Next Act, How Sustainability and Technology Are Reshaping China's Rise and the World's Future, published by early this year by Oxford University Press. Referring to issues like public health, AI, and biotechnology, Scott gives his views on how the U.S. should approach China, whether it's cooperation, competition, or conflict. Scott Moore is Director of China Programs and Strategic Initiatives at the Office of the Provost, as well as a lecturer in political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Moore was previously a young professional with the World Bank Group and served as Environment, Science, Technology, and Health Officer for China at the U.S. Department of State. He is also the author of Subnational Hydropolitics, Conflict, Cooperation, and Institution Building in Shared River Basins. Today, Scott and I talk about the U.S.-China relationship, how it's changed, and how U.S.-China competition could, under the right circumstances, still lead to global progress. So, Scott, thank you so much for joining me on the Asian Review Books podcast. You know, China is clearly a hot topic at the moment. Everyone's talking about China. Everyone's giving opinions on China. Everyone's giving opinions on what the U.S. should do about China. But what do you think is missing in our conversation about China, about relations with China, that pushed you to write this book?
Well, Nicholas, thanks so much for the invitation to join you and talk a little bit about what I learned, what I came to believe, and maybe a couple questions that I still have from researching and writing China's Next Act. It may be helpful to just sort of say a little bit about why I wrote the book in the first place, in answer to your question. And it really starts with a little bit of biography that you mentioned, which is that I had the opportunity to serve through an academic fellowship as the Environment, Science, Technology, and Health Officer for China at the U.S. Department of State. I have to say, I had that opportunity shortly after coming out of graduate school and doing a postdoctoral research fellowship, which, you know, in academia, everything is sort of around hyper-specialization, especially in graduate school. And kind of showing up at the State Department and being told, okay, your job is to cover all the environmental, science, technology, and or health issues related to China. Seem to be somewhere between laughable and maybe downright dangerous. But as I got into that set of responsibilities, I really came to think of them as pretty fundamental, not just to the U.S.-China relationship, but to China's role in the world more generally. And this was a period I was there around the time of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. And so a lot of the work was on responses to shared global challenges, or in sort of more academic terms, they're often referred to as global public goods, things like public health or pandemic prevention, or trying to address climate change or protecting the stability of the world's climate. And interestingly, this may be something we come back to, Nicholas, but at the time, in addition to a lot of work on climate change in the context of the Paris Agreement, we were just coming off of what was at the time widely seen as a very successful example of U.S.-China cooperation in response to a very serious Ebola outbreak in West Africa that now has been largely forgotten. But at the time was a very, very serious infectious disease emergency and caused a lot of alarm around the world, but witnessed some really striking scenes of U.S.-China cooperation, including having People's Liberation Army units unloading supplies from U.S. Air Force transports in countries like Sierra Leone. Pretty hard to imagine now, but it happened. And that's really why I wrote the book, because I did have the opportunity to see up close that there was, in fact, in a galaxy far, far away, a long, long time ago, a time and a place when the United States and China were capable of doing things jointly that benefited not just both countries, but really the world at large. And that really planted a seed in my mind that when we think about, again, not just U.S.-China relations, which tends to dominate the discussion, but really China's role in the world and its relationship with most major countries around the world, the focus of that is increasingly China's role in addressing these shared global challenges. And I think the best examples of that we've seen are in the areas of public health and climate change and the environment, all of which I talk about in the book. But going forward, we're going to see China play a similar role with respect to setting rules of the road or regulating emerging technologies like artificial intelligence and advanced forms of biotechnology, synthetic biology, gene editing, et cetera. And I think what this all kind of boils down to is that China is indispensable in addressing all of these shared global challenges, whether it's sort of more in the realm of sustainability or more in the realm of technology. And yet, as you pointed out in your introduction, even as China has become more and more essential and indispensable to addressing all of these shared challenges, relationships between China and other countries have deteriorated. And I think, at least from a foreign or a Western perspective, working with Chinese entities, especially the Chinese government and the state, has become much more problematic for a whole host of economic, geopolitical, and even moral and ethical reasons. And so it's that kind of dilemma or that paradox that I really try to get at in the book, exactly why this vision that many, including myself, had less than a decade ago for the United States and China being able to work together to address shared challenges failed, and how we can lay the groundwork for a more constructive future going forward.
Right, because we tend to think of opinions about China, you know, as a battle between hawks and doves. With, I think, as you know in your book, you know, with the hawks seeming like they've one is the wrong, perhaps the wrong word, but the hawks are more convinced that they were right all along. But I mean, it seems like there's a, at least as you try to put forward in your book, there is kind of a better way to think about the U.S. and China. So it's not just we have to cooperate in all circumstances, which is a very extreme characterization of the dovish view, or compete in all circumstances, which is the hawkish view. Is there kind of a better way to think about that balance between cooperation and competition?
Well, certainly that's the argument I make in the book, Nicholas. And I would say there are three kind of points there. One, and I do talk a little bit in the book about the sort of hawks versus dove divide, which, as you kind of alluded to, historically, that's been the major divide in terms of debate in the West, and particularly in the U.S., over how we should sort of deal with China, especially from a diplomatic perspective. And the main split was between people who favored more, to use another sort of common phrase, engagement, whether we should sort of be more open to working with the Chinese government and the Chinese state on a whole range of issues, versus those who favored a more aggressive stance toward China that was sort of much more centered on national security and sort of bolstering, again, particularly American national security relative to that of China. And this had been a really long-running debate that had sort of seen both sides have the upper hand at times. But over the last decade or so, we've seen two big shifts in that hawks versus doves divide. One is that the hawks appear to have won and in a more kind of durable way than they have in the past. And two, that kind of more hawkish perspective is becoming much more widespread across the West than it ever was in the past. The kind of hawkish view on China had been a feature of U.S. policy. There had been, some analogs to it in places like Japan. But the fact that it's now spreading to countries like Germany is a really substantial change. And I think kind of should lead us to believe that there are going to be much more difficult relationships between China and a whole host of countries, not just the United States and Japan and, countries that have always had quite problematic and complex sort of relations with China. The problem with that, the sort of, apparent win or victory of the hawkish position is that, again, China is really indispensable with respect to addressing these shared global challenges that we all have. And I actually opened the book by saying, I think if we learn one thing from the COVID-19 pandemic, it's that the world is bound together by these shared challenges, for better or worse. And at the center of those challenges stands China. I think that's something that, remarkably, as the COVID-19 pandemic became so global, China's sort of role in the pandemic kind of has become obscured. But it's a great example of how all countries and societies are largely in the same boat when it comes to these ecological shared challenges, and particularly public health and the environment, and also in emerging technologies. So that's sort of point one, that this sort of hawks versus doves divide, and in particular, the kind of ascendancy of the hawkish perspective, doesn't really account for that reality. That, whatever else may be going on in terms of relations with China, the cold hard fact remains that very little progress on shared global challenges can be made without it. That does get to a second point, which is I devote a lot of the book to, and is sort of a key theme that runs throughout the book, which is that we can actually achieve a lot more through competition than we often think. And in some cases, competition can actually be better than cooperation to produce gains for the planet and to address shared global challenges. And let me just say a few more words about that kind of headline statement. One thing that's a little bit of a bugbear of mine is how often in the context of China, we talk about competition versus cooperation without really defining what that means. And one of the things I try to do early in the book is propose a definition, for these words that we often use. And I think a key kind of component of both is that when we talk about cooperation, we both expect interaction or exchange to produce gains for both sides that are fairly equitable, so that not only can both sides kind of gain, but they gain more or less equally. And also that there's sort of a interaction and exchange and communication like is good for its own sake. When we talk about competition, on the other hand, you can still have gains for both sides, but the aim of interacting or trading or communicating is to have one side gain more than the other. I think that's really what we mean when we talk about competition in a China context. And I think those gains can be economic. They can be designed to ensure that, you know, U.S. firms gain a greater share of the market for a new technology, for example, even if you know, those firms are also exporting to China and potentially transferring some technology to Chinese partners, or gaining geopolitically. And I think it's in that context that this idea of we can actually make some shared progress on global challenges through competition as well as through cooperation comes into play. And the best example, one I devote a fair amount of attention to in the book, is clean energy development. And to make just sort of a, you know, quite a long story a little bit shorter, if we're going to solve the climate crisis, if we're really going to avert catastrophic climate change, we're going to need a new generation of clean energy technology. And that new generation of technology is going to require some substantial public investment in basic research and development. And that public finance, or that public investment, for better or worse, historically speaking, has often been driven by this kind of idea of geopolitical or military or security competition. We definitely saw that during the Cold War, when U.S. federal investment in basic science was really jump-started by kind of competition and rivalry with the Soviet Union. And we've seen that a lot of the major investments that the U.S. has made in clean energy technology have also had some link to China. The best example, I think, is the Inflation Reduction Act, really the only significant piece of climate legislation that the U.S. Has passed to date. And in his message to Congress, urging that they pass the bill, President Biden specifically referred to the potential of the bill, or the promise of the bill, to help America compete more effectively with China. So again, you see this justification for investment in clean energy technology really being rooted in more effective competition with China. I'd also point out that although the evidence isn't as clear, there is some strong indication that there's a similar dynamic on the Chinese side, which is that policy with respect to clean energy development and investment is driven at least in part by the desire to kind of strengthen China's competitive position economically, and to some degree from a security perspective as well, relative to the U.S. and other foreign countries. So this idea of kind of competition actually runs pretty deeply throughout a lot of climate and energy sort of policy action. And that kind of leads to the third point that I would make, which is not only can, and this is something that I argue pretty strongly in the book, that not only can competition be good for the planet in some ways, like clean energy development, but actually we may have kind of conventional wisdom almost backwards when it comes to China, sustainability, and technology. Let me explain a little bit what I mean about that kind of conventional wisdom having it backwards. Typically, when we talk about issues like climate change and China, it's the kind of intuitive thinking, the unstated kind of assumption there is that if we want to tackle climate change, make progress on reducing emissions, we have to have cooperation between major emitters, the U.S., China, et cetera. Whereas if we talk about technology, especially emerging technologies or advanced technologies like artificial intelligence, that's totally fair game for competition, for rivalry between the U.S. and Chinese states, between U.S. and Chinese companies, universities, researchers, etc. I argue that we have that that kind of intuition more or less backwards. It's true, and I already sort of mentioned the example of clean energy development, but I go through a couple of other global challenges or global public good issues in the book. And one of the things that's really striking is virtually, like historically speaking, international action on these issues has always taken place against the backdrop of geopolitical competition. There's never been, or almost never been, a sharp kind of division between countries competing economically, geopolitically, ideologically, and taking some steps to try to address shared global challenges. So there's much less of a contradiction in terms between tackling shared global challenges and competing than we often think. But on the other hand, when you sort of come to the emerging technology side of the equation, failing to have high-level intergovernmental dialogue on just sort of setting some fundamental ground rules for the development of these really, really disruptive new technologies is extremely dangerous. And, you know, I go through several examples in the book, but one that is really, I think, striking and poignant is the prospect that gene editing, which is really a very democratic technology and that it's pretty easy to employ, doesn't require a huge amount of investment or training to use, that could lead to new forms of bioterrorism or, at a minimum, just increased biosafety risks from research that's being sort of improperly conducted in using proper safety protocols and things like that. That's a really, really frightening prospect and something that is fundamentally in the interest of all governments, including China's, to try to work with other governments to prevent. So I think actually what that leads me to argue is that competition can actually be good for public goods and for addressing shared global challenges, but it could be almost fatal when it comes to regulating emerging technologies.
Right. And that's actually kind of leading into my next question, which, as I said, like you know, despite the positive change that can still happen when in areas driven by competition, the US and China still need to cooperate. As you said, they need to cooperate on technologies like AI, on technologies like gene editing, technologies like biotech. Well, you know, not biotech, but a lot of these kind of very new technologies where, as you note, the ground rules haven't been set. And I guess the those who are more in favor of competition would probably say that's fine. You know, we don't need to cooperate, or perhaps that the U.S. should just set the rules themselves and then just make sure everyone follows them, you know, through whatever means necessary. But I guess maybe two questions. Kind of, what happens if the U.S. and China can't agree on these standards, on these rules of the road when it comes to these technologies? Like, what's the danger? And two, I guess in the short term, what's the, given where a relationship is, what's the likelihood that they might be able to still talk about these important issues?
So I do make the argument in the book that the U.S. and its allies and partners around the world should be investing a lot of energy and effort and resources in setting the rules of the road, because if they don't, I do think Beijing will seek to fill the gap. And one kind of
isn't there this fight now about kind of nominating directors of the new standard setting body? I forget what the name, the International Technology
ITU. Yes, and that's the International Telecommunications Union is one of the bodies. It's probably the best example of an international standard setting body where China has accumulated quite a lot of influence, and there have been at least a couple of cases in which that influence has been pretty effectively leveraged to benefit Chinese firms, in particular Huawei. And I talk about that that example in the book. There's a key kind of standard technology standard called polar coating that's integral to 5G network standards that Chinese representatives to the ITU managed to sort of get endorsed as the presumptive global standard. And it just so happens that Huawei owns most of the key polar coating patents. But so that there are lots of good examples of that. And I do make the argument that, Beijing will fill the gap. Another kind of key theme that runs through the book that really drives that concern is that China's a little bit distinctive in the developing country world in the resources that it has placed in becoming a leader and sort of an important player, both in these sort of public good areas like climate change negotiations, like public health, and like technology. Certainly there are other developing countries that play important roles. India, is a great example there. But China really is in a different league in the sense that Beijing has invested an enormous amount of money and state capacity to enable it to play a really important role and be a key actor in bodies like the World Health Organization or the ITU. And what that means for other countries like the U.S. is, again, as we sort of face a future in which these sustainability and technology challenges are going to play a bigger and bigger part in everything, in in essentially the future of everything, that influence is going to be increasingly important, and it is going to become a more intense competition with other countries. You asked, though, another important question, which is around how realistic is it to expect that the U.S. and Chinese governments, are going to be able to get anywhere on these shared issues. And I would say two things. One, there is actually more potential than you might think on certain issues. And I think in the biotech space, when it comes to biosafety and biosecurity, that's especially promising as an area for dialogue. For all of the politicization and sort of mutual recrimination that occurred during the COVID-19 pandemic around a lot of biotech stuff, developments in biotechnology are deeply concerning to Beijing for a number of reasons, not least of which that uncontrolled and unregulated research in areas like gene editing are deeply destabilizing and create major safety and security concerns. And so I actually do think there's quite a lot of potential for a serious multilateral dialogue along those lines. I think when it comes to climate change, there is actually also underappreciated potential for dialogue and engagement between the U.S., Chinese, and other major emitter governments around different climate intervention techniques. Sometimes that's referred to as geoengineering. So I think there are key areas in which there's really underappreciated potential. That being said, once you start to get over into the ethics of artificial intelligence and things like that, way too political, way too many sort of fundamental differences to expect much progress there. And that's where another kind of key themes and recommendations that I make in the book comes into play, which is that we need to find much more effective ways of working with networks of subnational and non-state actors, whether it's state or local governments, the private sector, universities, NGOs, both in China, the U.S., and elsewhere, to help address these shared global challenges. And I think that's particularly important in the emerging technology space, where the technology is advancing so quickly that governments just can't keep up, even when they want to. And that's as true in Beijing as it is in Washington. And almost by default, universities, labs, even individual researchers kind of end up being the de facto regulators. And so it's really important if you're trying to set kind of ground rules or mitigate risks of the use of artificial intelligence and other emerging technologies, you got to find ways to work with this very diverse set of actors below the governmental level. And as one final related point on that, I think when we talk about China, and particularly the U.S. and China, these are two very large, powerful, capable states. And I think there's an almost automatic rush to like think of U.S.-China relations purely in terms of the intergovernmental relationship. But actually, it's much deeper and more complex and more multidimensional than that. U.S.-China relations are the sum total, not just of diplomatic engagements, but you know, hundreds of thousands of individual, you know, university relationships, corporate relationships, on and on down the list. And I think that's an untapped or almost untapped part of the relationship that can be brought to bear when it comes to making some, you know, some progress on these shared global challenges. Final point I would make, though, you know, I don't want to claim that any of this is a silver bullet or panacea. And I think that even as we should shift our focus and sort of thinking about sustainability and technology as being at the center of China's role in the world, I think that should shift our focus beyond just the governmental level. But ultimately, you do need government-to-government agreements and ties to sort of ratify things and make real, durable, meaningful progress in addressing shared global challenges. So it's not that I think that these other types of actors and relationships are a substitute for intergovernmental relations. They're not, you know, an antidote to the tension and rivalry that we see at the government to government level. But they can help, and they offer a lot of untapped potential.
Now, you mentioned kind of these subnational networks, and you devote, I believe you devote a whole chapter of your book to human capital, to academic scientific cooperation between the U.S. and Chinese researchers. That's a network that's come under strain recently for a variety of reasons. Official law enforcement attention on potential espionage is one. Just general souring of relations. The U.S. has become a lot less attractive as a destination, again, for a variety of reasons. But I guess, how do you see, also inversely, China itself is probably a less attractive destination for American researchers too, again, for
that's
a variety
true too.
Of reasons.
Yeah.
How important has this academic scientific cooperation how important has it been? And I guess, can you see it recovering after this period of low tensions and after COVID?
Unfortunately, I don't think it will fully recover, at least in the near or medium term. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. I think political tension and the sort of fallout from the pandemic has I think it's accelerated what would be a natural trend toward less engagement and less interaction and communication between Chinese researchers and their counterparts in the U.S. And elsewhere. And I think the fundamental drivers of that are really China's own development, and in particular, the development of its scientific and sort of research capacity domestically and indigenously. So the kind of value added, if you want to think of it that way, or the attractiveness of going abroad, in particular to the United States, to study is less than it used to be. It still exists, and I think you will continue to see some of the kind of most talented Chinese researchers and most ambitious Chinese researchers want to train in the United States do exchanges and things like that. But I think the kind of relative attraction and disparity in terms of capacity and resources between the U.S. and China has shrunk, and so I think the political tensions and the pandemic and lots of other things going on in the world have accelerated, I think, sort of a natural transition. That maybe is a good sort of invitation to mention, though, one other kind of theme that I chart in the book, which is that when it comes to technology, and particularly the cutting edge of almost every technology area, what we've seen is that the gap between China and other economies has shrunk considerably, really quite dramatically, but it's still there. There is still a gap. And there are, I think, very good reasons to expect that gap to persist over at least the medium term. And I go into the detail in this in the book, but when it comes to science, technology, and innovation, a lot of the most important factors, the things that make an economy or a society highly innovative, have to do with very informal norms and kind of practices that are part institutional, part cultural. There are things like tolerance for failure, norms around the free expression of information, free exchange of ideas. And because those are such embedded, those are so kind of culturally and socially embedded, they're very difficult to change. And I think for that reason, it will be difficult for China, as you know, it currently stands, to match the innovative capacity of foreign countries. I hasten to add, though, that is not that observation, that finding, is not a cause for complacency for those who are concerned about the economic and innovation competitiveness of the United States or other Western countries, because one of the things that you see on virtually every comparative metric of innovation or technological development is that while the United States is ahead of China, it is often behind many of its peers, countries like Japan or Singapore, on a lot of these metrics. And so that observation that there is kind of an innovation gap is not a cause for complacency in the United States. And in fact, I think it should be a wake-up call for more investment in science, technology, and innovation. Just a little bit less prompted by the perceived threat of China per se, and more just by the somewhat lackluster performance relative to some of our what the U.S. often thinks of as its peer countries and economies.
You know, that's a great segue to my last question. Your book came out over the summer, and I was thinking about what were kind of the big stories that kind of deal with U.S. and China and global public goods, competition, cooperation, et cetera. And I came up with three. You mentioned one, the Inflation Reduction Act. There was also the Chips and Science Act passed earlier this year, a couple months ago, which is not explicitly about China, but many, many, many people use China as a reason to push for the bill's passage. There was also, finally, I was thinking through kind of other big China news stories. And while this isn't something you cover in your book, there was there's this whole delisting fight about kicking Chinese companies off of U.S. stock exchanges, which may have been resolved by this accounting deal, which shows that the U.S. China can still talk about things. Although maybe that's a different that's a different kind of problem. But I guess any or all of these stories, the Inflation Reduction Act, the Chips and Science Act, this fight and potential resolution of Chinese companies and U.S. stock exchanges, how do these kind of fit into your framework for understanding U.S.-China interactions?
Well, I think the SEC accounting standards kind of case is a good example of this argument that I do make in the book about the importance of the U.S., its partners and allies, leading the push for the formulation of norms and standards globally. Now, my argument about that is applying more to environmental issues, technology regulation, but this is nonetheless a good example where the U.S. Took a fairly aggressive position about requiring Chinese firms to comply with U.S. accounting standards, which are set a much higher bar for transparency than the existing Chinese equivalent, and essentially prevailed and won. And I think that is that's good. I think that's good for the United States. I think it's largely good for the world. It forces sort of the Chinese economy and key actors within the Chinese economy to be more transparent. I don't see why that's bad, except for, you know, perhaps anyone who was engaging in unscrupulous business practices. So I think that's a great example of a really sound policy decision. Again, I think there is a lot more to be done in the sustainability and technological arenas. So I would, suggestion, I guess, or call to U.S. policymakers would be to just invest a lot more resources in bodies like the ITU, as well as ones that sort of tend to more fly under the radar. One example that I talk a little bit about in the book is the Convention on Biological Diversity, which is a UN it's an agreement, but it's supported by several bodies that try to deal with biodiversity protection. China's been very active in that space, and I think potentially to the detriment of the global environment, and certainly of the influence of the United States, its allies and partners. So I think there are lots of organizations and areas in which the U.S. should kind of bring a similar approach to bear there. With respect to the CHIPS Act, I think I would say, and you're right that, you know, the word China does not appear in the bill, but if you look at the statements of pretty much everybody who supported it, they talk about the need to equip the United States to compete more effectively with China. Very similar concept to what you see with the Inflation Reduction Act. I won't go into great detail. I think the CHIPS Act has a lot of good features. I did write a piece for on this for Lawfare and have another piece forthcoming from World Politics Review on the CHIPS Act. I do think it's ironic that there are certain elements of the CHIPS Act that seem to potentially threaten to make the U.S. approach to science, technology, innovation policy look more like China's. Which has been much less successful and produced some pretty underwhelming results, as I sort of alluded to earlier. And one example of that is when you look at China's both investment and just sort of the structure of China's innovation ecosystem, it's far more centralized than is the case for the U.S. And what the CHIPS Act does is concentrate a lot more authority and resources in certain federal agencies. It does a lot of other things too, but that's one aspect of the bill that I think could potentially crowd out some more decentralized innovation, which has been really critical, I think, to U.S. innovative capacity over the last few decades. But certainly at a high level, it's good that the U.S. government is making this investment in science and technology and innovation. And again, it is motivated primarily by China, which I think underscores one of the arguments that I make, which is this sort of idea of competition can be harnessed for useful ends, as long as we sort of do that responsibly and also keep in mind the ultimate goal or objective, which is to make progress in tackling these shared global challenges. And that really, I think, gets to maybe the most important, most central, and maybe the kind of last theme I would emphasize, which is, I think if you take away one thing from the book, it is this idea that China's role in the world really is increasingly and should be increasingly thought of mostly in terms of sustainability on one hand and technology on the other. And that's not only because China is increasingly indispensable in tackling all of these issues, and all of which are you know, increasingly becoming more and more pressing crises to solve, but also because for China itself, for in the minds of Beijing decision makers, these issues, thinking about climate risk, thinking about the implications of emerging technologies, many of which are very disconcerting, they play a really important role in shaping Chinese strategy and policy writ large. China's decarbonization policy, for example, is one of the most significant economic policies, and certainly one of the most significant technology policies that China has put forward, for example. So to the extent that we're concerned about what's going on within China and China's role in the world, we need to increasingly think primarily through the lens of these shared challenges, sustainability on one hand and emerging technologies on the other.
So I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Scott Moore, author of China's Next Act, How Sustainability and Technology Are Reshaping China's Rise and the World's Future. Scott, I actually have two more questions for you, just to wrap things up, which are, where can people find your work? And what's next for you? What's the next project?
Well, thanks very much, Nicholas, for that important reminder. The book's available on Amazon, as well as through a number of other online book websites. You can also find it and purchase it on the Oxford University Press website. And if you're interested in learning more about the book as a whole or about me, you can check out my website, which is scottmoorephd.com. In terms of what's next, you know, there are two kind of issue areas that really jumped out at me from writing the book as things that I think do require a lot more attention when it comes to China. One of them is biotechnology. And I sort of point out in the book that I think just looking down the road at the next few decades, biotech is really going to be the center of a lot of exciting developments in the commercial sphere and the health sphere, but is also going to be a major concern for security, for geopolitics, for ethics. And so I think that is a watch this space, China's role in biotechnology. And that's something I do want to focus more on. The second thing that really kind of jumped out at me as warranting a lot of attention is the potential for China, or I guess it's more the importance of starting to engage China on what are often referred to as climate intervention techniques, sometimes also called geoengineering. And without going into great detail, I think you can basically think of this kind of suite of ideas or actions as a sort of break glass in case of emergency, last ditch Hail Mary efforts to try to blunt some of the worst effects of climate change. Unfortunately, the prospect that someone or some country is going to try something in this in this area is increasing. The prospect of that is worrying for a lot of reasons. Several of these proposed techniques could have quite damaging environmental effects of their own. But if we think about the need to kind of create some guardrails around the use of these technologies, China, again, is critically important. But I don't get the sense that many people have thought about that, in part because they don't want to. And yet, I think we are quickly reaching a point in the global climate crisis where we're going to have to take more seriously this risk. And as with so many other global issues and shared challenges, China is central and indispensable to thinking about it.
So you can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network and NewBooksNetwork.com. This podcast is on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us continue to interview those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for a conversation with Mansi Choksi, author of The Newlyweds, Rearranging Marriage in Modern India. But before then, Scott, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Nicholas.